Welcome everyone to Animal Voices. Yes, and those were the calls of the sea lions, not at Drake Beach, I believe. Yes, I am convinced that we are only beginning to comprehend our fellow creatures. I don't believe that man is a superior animal, but is only one amazing being among a world of many others. In this program, Animal Voices, we explore the relationship between humans and other animals, animal welfare, vivisection, which is animal experimentation, endangered species, and other issues. Alan Jensen is in the control room. In the studio today, we have John Pranger and Marge Adams. My name is Carl Loskin. Within a few minutes, Marge will be speaking with Laura Matthias from the Phoenix Organic Farms and Bed and Breakfast in the Sandwich Peninsula. And at 12:20, John Pranger will be speaking with Dr. Sean Massonier, who wrote a book called The Natural Vet's Guide to Preventing and Treating Cancer in Dogs. At 12:40, Jerry Cook will be with us from North Carolina to inform us about a new project called the World Orchard Project. The best is yet to be. Stay tuned. In this program is produced by volunteer members of the Vancouver Humane Society, the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society, and Earth Save Canada. Something wonderful you can do for yourself and all life on Earth is to eat a diet of organic, unprocessed food that is free from animal products. The primary source of the foods we eat and the air we breathe comes from plants. And over to Marge.
Oh, thank you, Carl. Now, on the line, we have Laura Matthias, who is the owner-operator of Phoenix Organic Farm and Bed and Breakfast, as Carl said. But besides that, she has written a cookbook entitled Extravaganza, subtitled Original Recipes from Phoenix Organic Farm. Welcome to Animal Voices, Laura.
Thank you, Marge.
Now, Laura, perhaps we could start by having you tell us about your farm, a description.
Sure. My farm's on the Saanich Peninsula, which is just north of Victoria on Vancouver Island. It's about 11 acres, and I farm organic, certified organic produce, mostly a variety of different vegetables and some edible flowers and berries. And I've been here for about 2.5 years on this property.
Wonderful. Do you have many animals on your property?
Well, we have some chickens, which help with our pest control, and we have cats.
I see. Pest control. Now, you are strictly organic, so that is probably, could be a problem. Is it a problem for you?
Well, the pests aren't too bad here. Half of my farm is left sort of in a natural state. We have a natural seasonal floodplain, and it's full of lots of birds and wildlife and some good bugs and ladybugs and things like that. So mostly things stay in check here, but part of it is rotating our crops and doing things like that and companion planting and mixing our plants and moving them around a lot so that we don't have a big pest problem.
What do you mean by companion planting?
Well, that's when you plant two or more plants together that help benefit each other and support each other, and then they're healthier and stronger and they're better able to survive if there is a pest.
Could you give us an example of the ones that would survive better together than apart?
Well, sometimes people plant beans with corn or squash, and the beans help to fix nitrogen into the soil, and squash and corn are heavy feeders. So that's something where they give a bit of strength back to the heavy-feeding plants, and that makes them stronger and grow better and survive all the different things and stresses, like less water or bugs or things like that.
Oh, and what about a plant like garlic? Would that be useful to fend off bugs?
Yeah, garlic is in the onion family, and that's a good, strong vegetable, and it's good to rotate that through areas as well, because a lot of bugs don't like that, and they'll stray from that area.
And how do you deal with the weed problems?
Well, we do a lot of stuff by hand on our farm, and it takes a lot of time, but we weed by hand, and you try to get things before they go to seed and spread their seeds everywhere, but also rotating and keeping things covered with cover crops and
Now you talk about doing a lot of this by hand. You must have help on your farm.
Yes, we do. My farm is involved in the WOOF Canada program, which stands for Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And we have folks coming internationally to stay with us, and they work on our farm and provide labor for me, which is critical. And in exchange, they get to stay here and have accommodations. They learn about organic farming, and they get to have hands-on experience and get out there and pick and grow and cook the vegetables that they're dealing with every day.
So they're really volunteers, but they get room and board. Is that how it works?
Absolutely, yeah.
And probably very interesting people you meet, too, as a result.
Yes, we've had some wonderful folks stay with us and people from all over the world, and we learn new languages, and it's a lot of fun to try and communicate sometimes, but it's really good. It's beneficial.
Some of them are not really very fluent in English, yeah?
Most can speak some English, but a lot are coming and traveling because they want to learn English as well.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now, I obviously you have a very busy life, but you have managed to write a cookbook. How did you manage to do that with all the rest that's going on?
Well, I've been a vegan for 17 years, and I chose a plant-based diet as a teenager and started working in the biology field, doing field work as a teenager as well, and I've been doing that for years. And my career choices and my value systems have kind of been aimed at trying to find solutions. So doing work with endangered species was part of that, and then I started farming because I was interested in learning about food more, and the B&B, I run a bed and breakfast as well here, and that was part of using the food on my farm. And part of having a vegan diet, I had to learn how to make myself delicious, wholesome, nutritional-filled food, and it just sort of became one of those things that found its way into my life as I had to cook every day anyway. So
yes, you blended your biology, your entrepreneurship, and your cooking all together. You got a well-rounded life in that particular field of operation. Now, give us an overview of what is in your cookbook. I know it's just not recipes. It's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, the book talks a little bit about my farm and thinking about what's, you know, on your plate, what you're eating and where it's coming from and how far it's traveled and things like that to make you think about it, regardless of what your diet choice is. And it is also filled with a bunch of recipes, all plant-based recipes, over 200 of them. And I have a section on edible flowers and another section on natural food dyes, just to provide people with some opportunities for, you know, adding color and style and elegance to their plates without having to go to using artificial dyes and things like that, which a lot of people are having a lot of problems with.
Yes. Now, what flowers do you recommend for eating?
Well, in the book, there's a whole list of them, but there are all kinds of flowers edible. We on our farm, use a lot of nasturtiums or Johnny Jumps-ups, which are a little violet, and we have borage flowers. And when our kale starts to sprout, we use those flowers and petals in some of the salad mixes that we make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Since you are operating a bed and breakfast, do you have a lot of concentration on breakfast menus?
Oh, within the cookbook? Well,
yes. Mm-hmm.
It's I think pretty well rounded. I do provide a lot of the breakfast recipes in the book as well, but there's a whole assortment of appetizers and soups and salads and dressings and main dishes and pastas, and then a whole large section on desserts and cakes and cookies and puddings and all those things too.
Would you recommend your book to people who are not yet vegan but sort of moving in that direction?
Oh, absolutely. The book is really for anybody. I mean, anybody can eat plants, mm-hmm. I think. And so this is a book full of delicious recipes that you can take these and add them to any meal if you want to. And it's about thinking about, like I said, what is on your plate and how to present it in a nice way, because people do eat with their eyes as well in a way, and the presentation of food is very important to people.
Yes, I'm sure, and seems to be increasingly so these days. And also organic, of course, is increasingly important. You probably have no trouble at all in marketing your product, do you?
No, I can barely grow enough. Obviously, I provide it for my family and for all of the folks that work here on the farm. And for the B&B guests that come, they get a wonderful farm fresh breakfast every morning. And we also sell the vast majority of our stuff to a number of restaurants in Victoria and box programs as well. And we have some great support with some incredible chefs and restaurateurs who are very supportive of the organic movement and will buy just about everything we can grow.
Wonderful. That's great to hear because it's more nutritious and certainly safer food, isn't it, without all the pesticides and herbicides that
go with it. Absolutely, and they can taste the freshness, and for them to be able to deliver that to their clientele as well and to, you know, announce that it's coming right from here in our own backyard, so to speak, is a boon for them, and it draws people into their restaurants, so it's beneficial for them and for me.
Wonderful. Now, give us the title of the book again, will you, and tell us who publishes it and so forth?
Right. The book is called Extravaganza. It's a play on being a vegan cookbook. So it's Extravaganza, original recipes from Phoenix Organic Farm, which is my farm. And New Society Publishers published this book. They are on Gabriel Island, and they have a whole number of wonderful books that people should take a look at as well. They're very progressive, wonderful company to have a book published with, all on recycled paper, and great, great folks to
now,
be
is the
working
book
with.
Out right now, or is it just in the throes of getting onto the shelves?
Well, I just received it hot off the press in the last 5 days, and so it's going to be hitting the bookshelves in the next few weeks. So you can find it through New Society Publishers on their website, which I believe is www.newsociety.com, and you can order it through me at my farm website, which is www.phoenixfarm.ca, or you can look in any bookstores in the next few weeks, and it'll be all over.
What about a phone number?
You can try me. Yeah, I have a toll-free number at 1-877-744-3544, and that's my farm bed and breakfast number. And if people wanted to order a copy, they can do that, or they can go to the website and send an email request as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Laura, for being on the program today and telling us about this. I'm looking forward to getting the book.
Yes.
I don't have a lot of vegan books, so that apart from a couple, so this will be a nice addition.
Well, great. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And good luck with your book.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Marge.
Yes, thank you, Marge. And the primary source of the foods we eat and the air we breathe comes from plants. I said that at the beginning of the program. It's wonderful to remember that. Something wonderful you can do for yourself and all life on Earth is to eat a diet of organic, unprocessed food that is free from animal products. Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. You can hear us on the internet at coopradio.org, and our webpage is www.animalvoices.org. Within a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Dr. Sean Massonier, but maybe we'll just have 30 seconds of a little music, and then I'll tell you something. I have a wonderful reading here from John Robbins' book called The Food Revolution. So over to just a little bit of music here. Thank you, Alan Jensen. Welcome, yes, and you're back with Animal Voices. Shortly we'll be speaking with Dr. Sean, and he's very well known because of his he has a book called The Natural Vet's Guide to Preventing and Treating Cancer in Dogs. Well, Earth Save Canada has been a long-standing icon in the society here in Vancouver, and their mission is to promote the environmental and ethical consequences of our food choices, the environmental, ethical, and consequences of our food choices. Yes, that is important. And they also advocate the move towards a plant-based diet for better health and for sustainability and compassion towards non-human animals. Well, John Robbins was in Vancouver many years ago, and he said in a wonderful editorial, which he also wrote in his book, The Food Revolution, John Robbins, he wrote,
The
power of darkness in our world is great, but it is not as great as the power of the human spirit. We can learn to provide for our needs and limit our numbers while cherishing this beautiful planet and its resources. It is in our nature to honor the sacredness of life. What is at stake today is enormous. It is the destiny of life on earth. At such a time, walking a path of honoring ourselves and the living planet is our responsibility as citizens of the planet, but it is something more as well. It is also a joy and a privilege. And that's what John Robbins wrote in the book called The Food Revolution. And over to John Pranger.
Thanks, Carl. And we have on the line Dr. Sean Messonnier, who's a doctor of veterinary medicine and a holistic veterinarian and nationally recognized expert on integrative medicine for animals. He's a graduate of Texas A&M University School of Veterinary Medicine and the author of several books. Dr. Messonnier is a regular holistic pet columnist for the Dallas Morning News. His popular column is distributed across North America by Knight Ridder News Service, and Dr. Messonnier has shared his thoughts on integrative pet care with millions of pet owners as a contributor to various pet publications, including Dog Fancy, Cat Fancy, Cats, Veterinary Product News, Whole Dog Journal, Animal Wellness, Veterinary Forum, Whole Cat Journal, AKC Gazette, Vegas Dog, Dog Nose News, Body and Soul, Natural Horse, and Pet Business Magazine. Thanks for coming on the show today, Dr. Messonnier, or shall I call you Dr. Sean?
Dr. Sean is great. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is wonderful. Now, enormous sums of money are spent researching cancer, and we've been doing this for a century and more, and much of it is wasted, in my opinion, and many doctors' opinion, on misleading animal experiments. Why is it that it is still the leading cause of death in pets and the second leading cause of death in humans?
Well, I think it's because we really don't have an effective cure for many kinds of cancers. For some cancers, if they're discovered early, complete surgical removal, it can certainly cure the problem. In pets, you know, a lot of owners get concerned about side effects from chemotherapy drugs. And the fortunate thing, the good news is we rarely have side effects from chemotherapy in pets. But the bad news is the reason we don't is because we use lower doses of those drugs than in people. So when I have a pet with cancer that needs chemotherapy, probably the pet won't be cured. It will die with cancer, but instead of dying today, it'll die a year or 2 years from now.
Now, there are many different kinds of cancer in human beings.
Yes.
Now, you're dealing with just one species, the dogs, but amongst dogs there is, you know, innumerable differences. How does this? How are dogs treated in the kind of medicine that's sort of one size fits all?
Well, you know, with my approach, which is a very integrative or holistic approach, one size doesn't fit all. I look at every pet as an individual and determine what's best for that pet. So when I have a pet with cancer, for example, we'll talk to the owner and we'll go over all the conventional options, surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. Then we'll talk all about the natural options, the herbs, the homeopathics, the supplements, the diets that can help minimize side effects from conventional therapies, boost your pet's immune system, and keep them in remission longer. So to me, every pet's an individual. And that's why when an owner asks me, well, how do you treat cancer in pets? I have two answers. First of all, I don't treat cancer in pets. I treat pets with cancer. I don't treat cancer. I treat pets. And every case is different. Even the same kinds of cancer are different because there are so many factors I have to consider, and those factors will determine how your dog's treated with cancer, but that's different from the next pet that I see.
So while conventional wisdom regards cancer in dogs as untreatable,
yeah,
you don't think so?
No, absolutely not. And even a lot of conventional doctors will tell you that we can treat pets with cancer. They may not get as aggressive as I do because they're limited to surgery, chemo, and radiation, whereas I have all these other options, especially, for example, a dog, let's say, that has liver cancer. as a rule, there really are no drugs to treat liver cancer in pets. That's pretty much a death sentence. So all that I can offer owners are these other natural therapies, the herbs, the supplements, etc. Even then, I know I'm not going to cure that pet, but I can at least offer them some extended time and some quality of life with an owner. So the cancer is not an automatic death sentence, even though it's not a good disease for that pet to have.
Now, how do you reconcile in your mind the two approaches, the one sometimes, or these two approaches, the conventional and the unconventional, being at sometimes, it seems, in bitter antagonism, and conventional medicine denounces alternate medicine as unscientific and unproven?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote this new book, The Natural Vet's Guide to Preventing and Treating Cancer in Dogs, is because I wanted to give pet owners all the current science on both the conventional therapies as well as these natural therapies. There is a lot of research on a lot of this. Some of it comes from clinical experience rather than well-controlled research studies, but we still know a lot about what works. And what's nice about this natural approach is I'm not afraid to tell someone, I don't know if your pet with this kind of cancer is going to respond to this therapy, but let's try it because I have nothing else to offer. So I'm very open-minded to trying whatever is in the pet's best interest. If we have a lot of good research, great, and a lot of research is in that book. If we don't have research on specific products, that's okay. Intuitively, I know that they should work. Then we just need to try and decide, will it work for your pet with this kind of cancer?
So perhaps the answer is not a magic bullet, but rather
Correct. Prevention,
as it is in human cancer, surely. Can you tell us how we can prevent cancer in our pets or dogs? I don't know. Do you treat all other pets as well as dogs?
Well, we treat dogs, cats. We treat exotic pets like snakes and had a guinea pig yesterday, birds. We get a variety of pets.
Wow.
And as you mentioned, you know, part of the title of this book is preventing cancer as well as treating cancer in dogs.
Yes.
And there are a lot of things we can do. You know, we don't always know the exact trigger for cancer, but we know that at the cellular level, we have DNA damage, we have oxidation, which is a byproduct of cellular metabolism, and these cells are damaged and they're not healing themselves well. Some of that can be breed-related, and we certainly see certain kinds of cancer in certain breeds of dogs more than other breeds. We know that doing things like giving pets vaccines every year are not necessary for health and may be detrimental to health and may cause things like cancer. Feeding pets a lot of the pet foods on the market that have a lot of harmful byproducts and chemicals in them are not good. So in the book, The Natural Vet's Guide to Preventing and Treating Cancer in Dogs, I outline a lot of these causes and actually present the readers with kind of a step-by-step approach to, if I can't guarantee your pet won't get cancer, what are some things we can do to at least limit that pet's chance of getting not just cancer, but any of these chronic diseases that come about as a result of inflammation, oxidation, and DNA damage.
So is it easy enough for a pet owner who has no expert knowledge to devise a diet that is that will be preventive in his pet?
Absolutely. And there are a lot of examples I give in the book about how to find a good diet. Or if you're wanting to prepare something, we have some recipes in there. I wrote another book a few years ago called The Natural Health Bible for Dogs and Cats that has about 100 pages in there on selecting a good food and putting together a good diet. So the information's out there. I encourage pet owners so that they don't have problems with this kind of thing. Don't just get the book, read everything, think you know it all, and start applying it to your pets. This is going to give you some background information, and the goal is going to be you can work with your veterinarian, or if your doctor's not open to this, find a nice holistic veterinarian like myself, present the information. A lot of times you'll have more questions after reading the book, but you'll see things like this diet may help, this supplement may help, and then you can start a communication with your doctor and say, would this work in my pet, knowing what my goals are?
A fairly certain guideline would be to have the food raw, would it?
Well, you know, that's a very controversial topic. I'm not opposed really to raw or cooked, as long as the food is handled properly, the diet's very well balanced so we don't cause any nutritional deficiencies, and if we're using some good organic, wholesome meats and grains, whichever works for the owner and for the pet is fine with me.
Organic seems to be the key to many things. We've gone the chemical way in thinking that we could improve our lives, and yet that's kind of backfired in our faces, hasn't it?
Well, I think we're actually going backwards now to say, you know what, instead of all the chemicals, let's use them when they're necessary, but if they're not necessary, can we do something more natural without all the antibiotics and the hormones and the drugs and the chemicals in there? And we know that there are health benefits of that. In my practice, I will use a lot of conventional therapies like chemotherapy and other drugs, but I use them in an intelligent, rational way. And when there's an alternative, I choose that alternative because it's usually safer for the pet.
What does cancer look like in different animals? And
well, you know, it really depends. In a lot of pets, it's solid tumors that the owners can feel. And I think one of the most important things that I point out in the Natural Vet's Guide to Preventing and Treating Cancer in Dogs is that if you see a little lump on your pet, don't ignore it and don't let your doctor ignore it. Today I had a little dog, for example, that came into my practice here in Texas, and we had a little lump, and I aspirated it with a little needle and syringe, and I could tell the owner immediately that this wasn't cancer. It was a little fatty tumor, nothing to worry about. But you can't tell that just by looking or feeling. So doctors that do that, I think, are really causing these pets an injustice because we can all make mistakes. If you think it's a fatty tumor but it turns out to be cancer, there's malpractice and maybe a dead pet. It's very simple to aspirate the tumor, and if a doctor doesn't know how to read those cells under the microscope, you can easily send it to any diagnostic lab, and they will give you some guidance as far as what kind of tumor it is and is it something to worry about. Other kinds of cancers might show up internally, sometimes in a blood test. Sometimes we'll feel a tumor in a pet's abdomen. I had a dog this week with a big tumor of its spleen. Sometimes on an x-ray or an ultrasound. I've seen pets that came in limping. We did an x-ray, and it turned out to be bone cancer, not arthritis. So we have all these wonderful tests at our advantage and disposal, and we need to use those when it's appropriate. And as much as possible, I like to prevent disease. So if we can do some of these things on a regular basis and catch cancer early, that's when there's a greater chance of curing it.
Because cancer develops very slowly and incubates, or no, I guess it, that's not right, the word, but it develops over quite a number
time.
Of years.
You know, you can't go from one cell to a big tumor overnight. It does take some time, and you do have a window of opportunity for many cancers where if you catch them early and you get very aggressive with your treatment, you may be able to cure a lot of these cancers.
So what can the average person expect from his veterinarian? To have this open mind as you have, or is it, you know, could be forced into strictly using conventional medicine and that's it?
Well, I think the latter is probably true for many people, that they're going to a conventional doctor for their own care or their pet's care. And if the doctor is not open-minded and isn't familiar with these therapies, he may tell them, look, there's no proof this stuff works. This is all quackish. Don't deal with it. Let me just handle it. So I think the best thing to do is if you can find a holistic doctor like myself and work with someone who's not just an alternative doctor, but who actually is middle of the road like I am. You know, we're not opposed to drugs and the surgery, and we may need those in a lot of cancer cases, but if that's all we're doing, we're really hurting the pet because the immune system is ultimately what helps determine how a pet or a person with a disease will do. And if we ignore that, as is so often the case with just conventional medicine, then we're only treating cancer halfway, and I'd rather treat it the whole way.
Do you have any political troubles as a result of your, your choices?
You know, I just wrote an article this week about something in our paper and got some hate mail from that. But, you know, the way I feel is, look, I'm going to be out there. I'm going to tell people my honest opinion about what to do. If other doctors are closed-minded, that's their choice, but don't talk bad about me. I won't talk bad about you. I tell people the pros and cons. There's nothing wrong with conventional medicine. I use it every day. But I'm not just limited by that. I also have all these other therapies at my option. So as long as your doctor is open to trying things, he doesn't have to learn all the things I've learned. He can refer you to a doctor like myself as long as he's open-minded. The concern I would always have is if that doctor says, no, it's my way, there's no other way that works, I would never tell someone that because there are many things I don't know and things I can't do. I have to have specialists to help me out. So I think if you're really trying to work with the pet owner, that's a good doctor. Someone who's closed-minded, I think, is really going to cause more harm than good. I've had a lot of pets that we've actually saved their lives that other doctors, including specialists, said nothing else could help their pet. And what they really meant was, I can't help your pet. But they didn't want to admit that. They just said no one could help your pet. And that's not true because in some cases, alternative medicine saved these pets' lives.
And even after the evidence is there, many people will deny it. So what is how large a body of evidence, clinical evidence, is there out there that doctors can resort to in order to know what you know?
Well, there's a lot of information, a lot of which we extrapolate from human data. Of course, a lot of things are tested on pets. What's nice about me is I also am very open-minded to clinical data. For example, if you come to my practice, and let's say I've used supplement A for 3 years and I've seen results, and you ask me, well, is there anything in the literature that backs up what you're doing? Well, maybe for that supplement, the answer is no. The company has to spend money on research because they know it's worked. Thousands of doctors have used it. Why are they going to spend the money to prove what they already know? So to me, I look at clinical evidence as very, very good evidence. I don't necessarily have to have all these controlled studies, you know, on research animals and that kind of thing. If something is working for me, I'm going to do it. If it doesn't work for me, I'm not going to do it. So I think it's good for people to ask, you know, what proof do you have? And the best answer I can give people who say that what I do doesn't work is come to my practice and every day and tell these pets they're really not feeling better, they're not getting better, their cancer isn't going away, they're no longer walking, even though obviously they are walking. Maybe they're no longer itching, but obviously they are no longer itching. So to me, as long as I'm seeing results in my patients, that's the best thing for me. And fortunately, holistic doctors will share a lot of information because we don't always have the control studies we'd like, but we still have clinical data. And if I know if something's worked for another doctor, I'm going to try it, regardless whatever research is out there.
So it may be derided as anecdotal by some, but that's perfectly scientific to me. It seems to me that observed effects are legitimate.
Well, absolutely. You know, it's kind of like saying, you know, a criminal is convicted by circumstantial evidence. Well, circumstantial evidence means of the circumstances. If you have a ton of circumstantial evidence, which is actually better than eyewitness evidence, that's still enough to convict someone of a crime. Well, for me, if I have enough clinical or circumstantial or anecdotal evidence that this product, this therapy continues to work day after day in my patients, I'm happy with that. I don't have to go find this in a research paper somewhere. If I do, great, but if I don't, I'm still going to use it if it works.
Well, I profoundly distrust any experimental evidence from lab procedures, lab animal experimentation, because those are notoriously unreliable since you can't extrapolate from one species to another safely.
Well, and they're also controlled studies. You know, when I lecture to veterinarians about, for example, if there's any proof any of this stuff works, I talk about, for example, non-steroidal drugs, which are very, very popular in people and in pets for controlling arthritis. And if you look at research, for example, in pets, when you're testing a drug like a non-steroidal in a pet, that drug is tested on a few hundred or a few thousand laboratory animals that are very controlled with their diet, they don't have other diseases, or a certain weight, a certain breed. How can you possibly say because 1,000 laboratory beagles didn't have a reaction to this drug, the pet in front of me who's 15 years old on 3 other drugs and sick with other diseases won't have a reaction? And that's why a lot of times when drugs come on the market, we find out problems after they're tested in the general population, because you can't get that with research data. You have to have clinical evidence to show something's good or harmful.
In the case of Vioxx, it was supposed to be good for mice, the hearts of mice. So there you go. And then
that's a good example.
And the company got away with killing a whole lot of people, it seems to me. I think it was a crime, but apparently it's not officially a crime. So that's just the way things are set up.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see what happens with that, sure.
Yeah. Now, you did mention vaccines. If I could just briefly have you say something about that, and then we'll have to end the conversation.
Sure. Well, one of the things I talk about in the Natural Vet's Guide to Preventing and Treating Cancer in Dogs is that vaccines can be helpful, but they're way overused in pets. All the current data, and this is coming from conventional doctors, not holistic doctors, but the conventional doctors are actually coming out and saying these vaccines last longer than 12 months. We need to change what we're doing. Now, a lot of doctors are getting on board, and they're doing vaccines every 3 years. I still think that's too much for many pets. In my practice, in the book, The Natural Vet's Guide to Preventing and Treating Cancer in Dogs, we talk about a test called the titer test, which is a blood test for your dog or cat that lets you know what your pet's antibody levels are. And if they're normal, 5 years out, your pet doesn't need any more vaccines. So to me, I like the pet's body telling me what it needs. I think it's good that a lot of doctors are going to every three-year vaccines rather than every year, because at least we're decreasing vaccines by about 60%. But I'd rather decrease them every more. So I think we're headed in the right direction. We still have a lot of work to do.
Well, thanks very much for your time today, sir, and for the good work you're doing to defeat, hopefully, the scourge of cancer. And where is your book available?
Well, it's available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com and bookstores, pet stores. And if people want to learn more about natural therapies and see books, not just that I've written, but I recommend for pet owners, they can go to my website, which is PetCareNaturally.com. And just read about a lot of articles I have on there. Look at my recommendations for books for your own health as well as your pet's health.
That's Pet Care Natural, Naturally,
right? PetCareNaturally.com.
Thanks very much, Dr. Sean, and I appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much, and tell everybody in Canada hello for me.
Well, I sure will.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So you hear it, everybody. Hello from Dr. Sean Massonnier.
Yes, what a wonderful interview.
And we spoke to him from Texas.
From Texas. And we have shortly we'll be speaking with Jerry Cook in North Carolina. And when I spoke to him this morning, he was busy throwing frisbees on the beach. So, Marge, you have an announcement. Yes. You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Our webpage is animalvoices.org. And we can be heard on the internet at coopradio.org. Marge, you have an announcement.
Yeah, thank you, Carl. I just wanted to let people know about the Organic Islands Festival, which starts next Saturday, a week tomorrow. And it's on for 2 days, July the 8th and the 9th. And it involves 75 exhibitors, which is the largest organic fair in British Columbia. And they will be celebrating everything organic, sustainable, and local. Everybody is welcome, and it's going to be in Victoria. And the address, Glendale Gardens and Woodland, 505 Quail Road in Victoria. So that it sounds like a wonderful affair, especially for those people who are really interested in organic, healthy food.
Yes, thank you for that, Marge. And, you know, there's a wonderful poem written by Michael Glazer, and it does relate to our next person we're going to be speaking with, Jerry Cook, who is online. And it was about the presence of trees, written by Michael Glazer. And he wrote, "I have always felt the living presence of trees, the forest that calls me as deeply as I breathe, as though the woods were marrow in my bone, as though I myself were tree, a breathing, reaching arc of the larger canopy beside a brook bubbling to foam." Yes, that was Michael Glazer and a bit of poetry. And Jerry Cook is involved with the World Orchard Project. And this project is a way of expressing hopes and dreams of a more compassionate lifestyle for all animals, humans, and the environment through the rebuilding of the common areas. Well, hello, Jerry Cook.
Hey, Carl.
Nice to hear from you. And you know, this World Orchard Project and the idea of planting more trees. What a wonderful legacy one leaves when one plants trees. And tell me what it means to you and what you're doing.
Okay. Well, let me just say this. It's more than just trees to us. It's any type of plant that may bear some food, for not just for humans, but for non-humans alike, as well as giving back to the environment. I'm really, really strong on advocating us eating more wild berries and things, you know, the little small berries, not these great big old piffy things that they put out in the grocery stores today, you know, but the wild blueberries and strawberries and that sort of thing. So I'm really excited, and just as much planting those type. I hate to call them bushes. Maybe I ought to call them shrubs, huh?
Right, so you're going about advocating this, and you're going on a tour to do what?
Well, just to talk about it, to drum up interest, and you know, I could go out and plant a tree every day, and at my old age, that probably wouldn't be a whole lot of trees in my lifetime. But gosh, if I could get, you know, like I think the population of this country, America, United States of America, there is what, 300 million. Suppose every person planted a tree. So you know, that's my dreams, is to have people planting at least one fruit-bearing tree in their lifetime in an area that we call commons, you know, where it's accessible to anybody to partake of it, you know, who doesn't have to have money or doesn't have to buy it, you know.
Now, it just applies also very much to third world countries where
yes.
There's a horrendous rate of infant mortality and people
right.
dying of starvation. You have some of those figures. It's staggering.
Yeah. My you know, I'm a 100-er, but that doesn't compare too much with Bill Gates and his billions, and there Warren Buffett throwing in his billions. But you know, their intention is also to help out the children, to feed them, help them health wise. But you know, I want to get down to the basics. You know, before they get sick, let's get up some good nutrition out there. And can I throw around a few stats there? you know, I go back to like 911. Everybody remembers 911. That was a 24-hour period there that if you asked anybody how many people died that day, they would think, well, 3,000, you know, because that's what died in the towers. But every 24 hours on this planet, 45,000 people nutritionally starved to death, and approximately 38 to 40,000 of them are children. But gee, you know, the children deserve better from us than that. Also, 120 total species are wiped off of this planet every 24 hours, just totally gone. Normal rate of attrition is approximately one every 4 years. And then they found a replacement about one every 4 years. So nature kind of balances out. But now we're just destroying that many species every day on this planet. So I think we need to start back to try to do something in a positive manner to try to offset that. It's a fun project. You know, it's really just fun. I can't think of many negatives about it. A good friend of mine said, oh, gosh, what are you going to do? All these people will be walking around stepping in fruit. And I said, I hope so.
Now, Jerry, one of the things that really struck me when I spoke to you this morning earlier was that I said to you, well, these trees, many of these fruit trees, orchard trees, they require water. But you had a very striking answer to that. Maybe you can give it to us.
Absolutely. You know, where there are deserts there, in a lot of them, that used to be a forest before we cut down all the trees. And when you cut down the trees, it stops raining. When you have more trees, you get more rain. You ever heard of the rain forest? You know? I mean, it works hand in hand. It gives back to the environment, and the environment gives back to it. So if we went out and started planting trees on the edge of a desert, per se, and started working our way out, chances are we would bring the rains back, you know, on a normal schedule. I don't know whether you ever read the book, The Man Who Planted Trees.
Give us a quote.
Well, the Man Who Planted Trees was a book that inspired me. And it's a fiction story, but, you know, it could have been real, of a guy who just started every day. He kind of lived alone and lived in an area where the trees had been decimated, and every day he would gather like acorns up, and then he would go home at night and select the best 100 and go out the next day and plant them. And that's what he did every day.
Right.
And then he
Johnny
started
Appleseed.
Putting in different species, and where there was once, you know, just a total desert, you know, it became a rainforest. At first, he had to do a little light watering, but you have to do that even when you plant trees a lot of times, you know, in your backyard.
Now, you live in North Carolina, and you talk about these commons, the common areas. Well,
yes.
Plant a tree somewhere, but have you been able to find an area that has been suitable and you have had success with your project?
Yes. In my neighborhood that I live in, we don't have much common area in here. It's a neighborhood of a couple thousand people right at the end of nowhere. It's actually on an island. And so I went up and started looking around in the records, and I found a couple of places that the association owned in here, and went and talked to the director of the association and got permission to plant trees and bushes in those areas. And we've done that here. Also, we've gone to nursing homes. And I really want to try to get, like, school-age children involved and maybe get them to go to, like, nursing homes or at least assisted living homes and maybe get the kids working with the elders again on the project, you know. The kids can supply the youth and enthusiasm and the backbone, and the wisdom can come from the elders, and maybe we can put together, this age separation that we've created in our society as well.
Now,
you and I are getting close to the age, Carl, where they go throw us away somewhere.
That's right. Fade into a nothingness.
Yeah.
Now, Jerry...
It's interesting. I just heard the other day, I think it's a little bit different, there's a twist on it, but I just heard, I think it was last week, my brother called me and said, did you hear? And that's, I'm actually a Virginian, but I live in North Carolina. There's a spot in the middle of Virginia in a kind of a wet area that Weyerhaeuser, which is a timber company, owns, and they found 40 acres of virgin forest in the middle of this property. And these cypress trees are just humongous.
Lovely.
And there's bound to have been some foresters, you know, just some underground foresters who knew about it, but it acted like it was a brand new discovery, which it pretty much was to most of us. And it just recreated a tremendous amount of excitement.
Now, Jerry, we only have a few minutes left, but many people know you because you're a famous musician, too.
Some people have accused me of being that, yeah.
You play the three-string dulcimer.
mountain dulcimer player. Now, yeah, I'm very proud. I was associated with the film or documentary Peaceable Kingdom, and I played some music in that and did a part in there and talked about the relationship between slavery of days gone by, the song Amazing Grace, and how it could relate right back there to where we are in today's world with our treatment of animals. You know, we treat them as economic units, and we once treated people, and sort of still do.
That's right. They are commercial units and nothing more. Now, of course, factory farming is rampant in North Carolina as it is.
Oh, yeah. When I drive toward the Raleigh area, which is about a 3.5-hour trip from where I am, and it's in a lot of back wooded areas along a peninsula of land between the Albemarle and Pamlico Sound, and about 50 miles inland, Carl, you come into this opening, and it's just they've decimated all the trees. And they built these hog houses and chicken houses by the hundreds. I mean, the hundreds of houses there. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of animals are kept there, but, you know, tears just come in my eye when I drive through there. And these holding ponds, these heavy rains, they leach out, and we get a fish kill. But recently we haven't had any fish kills, you know, and I figured out why. You want to know why?
Tell me, Fisteria, was it?
No, we've about killed them all.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Now, you know that that we had the Animal Voices Film Festival last year, and our main featured film was The Peaceable Kingdom, and it had tremendously, you should have read the comments that people made afterwards, how it influenced them.
I'd love to see them sometime.
And this year we played, Howard Lyman was here with his new documentary, Madcap. Are you on that as well?
You know, I might be in there in a corner of it. They interviewed me, did a little blip on it, but he had hundreds of hours of film to edit out.
Now, I can imagine you playing frisbee on the North Carolina beach, but, you know, I saw you in real life here when you were at least 15 years ago and you came to Vancouver for the Earth Save International convention here in Vancouver.
Right.
And we went out in the boat in English Bay, and it's kind of a wonderful thing to do.
Yes, it was. I tell you what, y'all live in my favorite large city that I've ever been into. Vancouver is it. That's number one. Now, I've been into 48 of the 50 United States and about 5 or 6 of the provinces up there and a lot of major cities. And I tell you, y'all just got such a neat thing going up there. I really hold y'all in high esteem.
Thank you, Jerry.
Plus, you got one of the greatest nutritionists not far away either in Brenda Davis. So.
She's great.
Yes.
Brenda Davis and and Vicente.
She's on our board of advisors. Also, Harold Brown, who is kind of the featured person in Peaceable Kingdom as far as people go. We like to say the animals are the feature, and we're just secondary. But Harold is also with me on this project, a World Orchard Project.
Well, you know, thank you, Jerry Cook, for linking the three-string dulcimer music with a compassionate lifestyle for all animals. And thank you for being on Animal Voices with your World Orchard Project.
Thank you. I hope to get out to your area soon. Maybe we can go plant some trees together.
You'll be welcome.
Right,
and over to Alan.
Y'all have a good day.
Thank you, Jerry.
Bye-bye.
And over to Alan Jensen, and we'll have a short piece of music, and then we'll do a little bit about how to deal with animals in the summer.
Are you a creative writer? Like to express your thoughts by words and want to introduce your work to new audiences? Then here's your chance. Co-op Radio is holding a live poetry fundraiser where you have the chance to perform your poem, create a piece under the theme Community Dreams, collect a $100 prize, a place in a chapbook workshop, personal creative coaching sessions, on-air time, or exposure in Co-op Radio's listener guide. Just submit your piece, your contact details, and a $2 administration fee to Co-op Radio, 360 Columbia Street, Suite 110, Vancouver, BC, B6A4J1. For more information, email us at communitydreams@gmail.com or call 604-684-8494. Become a part of our community dream and send in your piece today. Once again, contact us at 604-684-8494 or email us at communitydreams@gmail.com.
Deadline June 30th.
Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM. And our theme of the day is the primary source of the foods we eat and the air we breathe comes from plants. And something wonderful you can do for yourself and all life on Earth is to eat a diet of organic, unprocessed food that is free from animal products. Well, yes, as I said before, we would like to, summer is coming and it seemed to come real early in Vancouver, so, and a long weekend coming up. But how do we deal with many of the critters that come into our house and sometimes they're considered to be somewhat of a nuisance? Well, I remember very well while traveling in Thailand and Myanmar that I went to a Buddhist monastery, and I noticed that the monks all had bells on their gowns, and you know, and they were wearing sandals. Of course, it's quite warm. The reasons they were wearing bells there was somewhat symbolic, and that was to let the ants know that they were coming and they would not step on the ants. Well, I had to consider this because at this time of the year, ants are really creative in coming into your kitchen, and I found that even I was, I'd cut up an orange and the juice of the orange was on the counter. And within 3 or 4 hours of me not being there, ants had collected there, had literally formed a stream, and was were consuming the now it's difficult to keep the ants out of the wash basin and things like that. So this is the recommendation, is to keep your kitchen really clean and not to invite the animals into the kitchen. So keep them out by keep your food items in the fridge, and don't spill on the floor because they'll find it. It's incredible their sense of finding in and zeroing in on what is edible for them and what they'd like to take home. So in North America, homeowners spend some nearly $5 billion a year on pesticides, and into my mind, a totally vain attempt to create homes that are free of pests. Not only are these substances toxic to children and companion animals, they also provide a short-term solution. Yes, they're a short-term solution. And so, as we mentioned, keep your kitchen area clean for the larger animals. Keep the trash cans securely covered. And in the garbage trash, you know, the trash, you should, the raccoons tend to knock over the trash can, so it should be secure. If it falls over, it doesn't spill out onto the driveway, and then they become habituated. I believe this is one of the things that's done. They put a bit of pepper on these to discourage the animals, but I believe that's somewhat cruel. So raccoons and other animals, to prevent them climbing onto your roof, maybe you'd like to trim your trees now, especially at this time the trees have put out lots of new growth. So trim the trees and cut them away from the roofs and foundation walls. And a few weeks ago we spoke about wasps. I have a family of wasps just outside the sunroom, and I spoke to somebody about it, and I said, you know, I've never been stung by these wasps. So he said to me, well, you know, you don't pose a threat to them. And I know Marge, you and I have something in common here, because we rescue wasps and bees and bumblebees from these windows. They come into your house, and tell us, how do you do it, Marge?
Well, my latest invader is hornets. Not a
a whole lot of them, but just in the last few days I have rescued at least two or three hornets. And what I do is open the door wide, the sliding glass door. That seems to be how they get in. And because I'm always letting my cat in and out, and I think they just come in and when the door is open for the cat. So that what I do is get a magazine, fair-sized magazine, and kind of guide them to the door, and they just get within about 6 inches of the opening, and whoosh, out the door they go.
But you told me a different story before, and that was you take a glass.
Take a glass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are hornets. These are different than what I've had previously. Okay. What was I telling you about?
With the wasps. Wasps. And anyway, you take a glass, and they're easily cornered because they're flying against the window pane, mm-hmm. and then you put them inside the glass, and then you slide a piece of paper in the side, and you know what I find so exciting is that when you see them fly away, you know, they just seem to say, thank you, we're free.
Right.
And we're right out of time. And I like to just conclude by thanking Alan Jensen for being in the in the control room. John Pranger is on the mic, and Marge Adams. And I'll tell you that I am convinced that we're only beginning to comprehend our fellow creatures. And I don't believe that man is in any way a superior animal, but is only one amazing being among a world of many others, and that's why we're on Animal Voices, and thank you for listening.